Okay. Welcome everyone to the Arizona State Hospital Independent Oversight Committee. It is April 17th, 2025. It is 6 p.m. And at this point, we have made quorum. We have Alice, Janina, myself, Chuck, Jane, and Kay on. And I'm not sure about others, but that makes us meet quorum. So let's begin. Before we begin, do we have anyone that has a conflict of interest that they need to disclose? And if so, please state why. Hearing none, let's move on. So has the committee been able to review the meeting minutes that Larry sent out? And
yes.
If so, do we have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, anyone opposed? Hearing no one opposed, the minutes are approved as presented. Updates from ADOA?
Hi, Lori. This is Larry. Quick update. I sent you the trifold brochures and business cards to you. Did you receive those okay?
I just got back in the country and I opened our mail today and we received them. So for the committee members, anyone that wants to, let me know and I'll meet up with you and give you some brochures so you can ask anyone that you think would be a good candidate to join our committee. It talks about the committee. It has the link to become a member. And then we also have cards. Oh,
yes.
If I could get them, that would be great.
Okay.
If you want to mail them to me at the hospital, I can talk to you later about it, Lori.
Okay. Now also, Jane's mic isn't working. Oh, Jane had a question about the meeting minutes. So pending the problem that we had a mic issue, Jane, can you speak now? I don't see your mic on. Sometimes star six can get it working as well.
Star six is probably.
So Jane, do you want to drop and try again or do you want to type your question in? Did her motion to have the hospital? Yes. We'll give an update on the two motions, but that made it. I don't know. Was that reflected, Larry?
In the minutes?
Oh, no, because that was an executive. I'm trying to remember.
No, it was. Yes, we received a response back from ASH admin on that. Yes, we did.
Yeah. I know that we had a response, but was it in the minutes? It should have been.
The question was in the minutes, but the response itself was not. That was sent separately, yes. So I think it's loaded in the G Drive for you guys, if I'm not mistaken. Okay.
And I had that response.
Lord, I'm unable to know what you're talking about. Because I'm not sure what the issue is, because nobody has stated what you're talking about.
Oh, Jane, her mic wasn't working. Her question is, did my motion to have the hospital provide tampon for women get reflected in the minutes? Larry said yes. Now, the answers aren't in the minutes, because that's just when we talked about it and provided motions. We do have a response from the hospital that was sent to me, and I thought I'd forward it to everyone, but we'll discuss it when we do admin update or hospital update. Okay, Jane, is that good?
Lori,
Jane's good.
Okay. The track flow brochure and the business cards were really the only update I had to the committee. I am working on having another one pager that's a little bit more email friendly, that has the QR code and the information on how to apply as well. So I'm having that created. I should have that done here in the next week, I would imagine, maybe sooner. So as soon as I get that done, I will send that out to the committee. Other than that, I don't have any other updates. Are there any questions for me that I could try to answer for the committee?
I think the only one, if there's any, that you could address will be in one of the motions that we asked the ASH administration update. If there's any more questions on number one, I think as ADOA, you could respond. But the first motion, we asked the hospital how to register a pet partner team as a private person and also a private dog. The response was, all entities that provide services to the state must register as a vendor with the state procurement office as detailed. And there was a link with the how to do business in the state, whether that business is free or for a fee. Once registered, an organization may be notified if any agency in the state seeking a service that they are qualified to provide. The agency may solicit for a specific service in which multiple vendors may respond. There is no guarantee that a vendor will be chosen to partner with an agency. And due to ongoing litigation, the hospital is not able to further comment on specifics surrounding that matter. Also, there was a discussion that if the vendor and the dog did that, would the hospital say they'd use it? That's kind of illegal. That would be like saying, I have a friend and you must use them. That's illegal. And as a committee and as a person, we could not do that. And no one on the committee could do that. Anyone that wants to provide that service can follow the procedure and sign up. And just because they sign up, that does not guarantee that they're going to provide a service in any specific state agency. So we just wanted to be clear on that. And if there's any questions, Larry can field them.
I have a question, and I don't know if it's for Larry or if it's for Mike Sheldon, but how does a person who's not a corporation register through the ADOA? Because it looks like through their website, you have to be a corporation to actually register. So how does one volunteer if you're not a corporation?
That would be for Larry, since he works for ADOA.
Well, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest with you. That's a good question, Kaya. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason why. I'm sure there's insurance. I know there's insurance requirements and a finger one level fingerprint card that they have to pass as well. So there are certain parameters that our procurement department puts on vendors. Now, I'm not sure about your question. I would have to send that up directly to my procurement department to ask.
Okay, I appreciate answer. That. Thank you, Larry.
Okay.
Do we have a motion that wants to ask Larry to talk to his procurement department to see if an entity needs to follow the same process? No?
I don't know. Do we actually need a motion for that, Lori, or can just let it take under advisement or what do you think?
Yeah, I can just take that question directly to my current department. I don't think there's a need for a motion for that.
I found some information. It says that the person needs to create an account on TrackCorp, the State of Arizona Learning Portal, and then to use an access code to create a non-state worker account, and then complete the required demographic information and the training required.
That's for the training or for the vendor?
For if, no, so to register as a volunteer through Arizona Department of Administration, you can begin by creating an account on TrackCorp, the State of Arizona Learning Portal, and volunteers need to use an access code AC3DB711 to create a non-state worker account and then complete the required demographic information. And additionally, volunteers will receive training opportunities offered to AZGFD staff and specialized classes for volunteers.
I don't want to confuse a person wanting to go and volunteer anywhere in the state with anyone bringing in animals for any type of pet therapy.
Yeah,
no, it may be two different things.
Yeah, no, so I was just referring to the like volunteer. I don't know how the pet therapy works.
Yeah, I will certainly look into that and how it differentiates between a corporation and an individual. I don't know the answer to that specific question, but Janae is right. So there are certain requirements that the individuals need to meet. So, but I will certainly get that answer for you guys.
Okay. The next motion was to ask the state hospital to start providing tampons for women patients. Hospital confirmed the vendor is able to supply tampons through their existing contract with the state effective May 1st. Female patients who prefer this as a hygiene product may request approval from their provider. And if deemed medically appropriate and safe, the item will be supplied. Of note, there have been numerous studies conducted on this issue with specific focus on patient safety. In 2024, the American Psychiatric Association issued a report that concluded if tampons are provided, they are usually to be stored at the nurse's station and given with a physician's order due to the potential risk of psychotic, cognitively limited, or suicidal patients swallowing a tampon, soaking it in prohibitive substances, or leaving it in vaginally too long, leading to risk of toxic shock syndrome. So, yes, they'll provide them to. You'll have to ask your provider to write an order that you're deemed safe to use them, and that you'll have to get them from the nurse. But at least you can get them. So that's good news.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Lori.
Okay. Next, so that was follow up on that. The female hygiene products, the pet therapy, payment authorizations for medical providers. We have had ongoing allegations that the hospital was taking a patient's checks anytime there were cash in the bank. This has been ongoing. We finally got to the point where the hospital, they did send out to us that all patients upon admission are given papers to sign, one of which is that if they have the means and they're not indigent and the hospital pays for medical services, that and then they get reimbursed by whatever method, insurance, money, benefits, whatever, then that money is to be provided to the hospital. We had the blanket form, and then we asked if we could get a copy of the signed form. And we made arrangements to have two people visit the hospital, Melissa and Janina. We informed the hospital, and remember, it's a three-day procedure to go in person with approvals and making sure we have someone to escort us. The patient that has made allegations refused a visit with the IOC because of certain... they had certain beliefs that really didn't have to do with the IOC, but they refused a visit. So we were not able to go in, see the form with their signature and bring it to the person and say, this is what you signed, here's your signature. But because we wanted to make sure that the patient had the right to see that they signed these forms, Tara and an investigator took the form, met with the patient, and showed them the form. Now, Tara, I'm not sure if you want to report your visit without disclosing anything.
So I and the hospital investigator, we went on to a unit on the forensic campus here at the Arizona State Hospital. We spoke with the patient in private, and we also showed the patient documentation with his signature on it. The patient was still unwilling to believe that it was his signature, but it was indeed his signature. And so, but he's okay. I got to see him this week make rounds. I saw him already, but he is under the belief that the hospital is misusing his funds and forging signatures, which is not happening because that is unethical and can go into a whole legal mess. The hospital did not forge his signature. The signature was his making at the time of his coming in a minute to the hospital.
So Jane, you have your hand raised?
I do. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Just a question. It's more of a theoretical question. Tara, does he have the ability to withdraw his signature from that agreement?
Does he have the ability to withdraw his signature from that agreement?
Yes. In other words, his agreement to those terms?
Jane, this is Mike. Hi, everybody. I think that the patient does have the ability to withdraw his signature, but the statute gives us the ability to proceed get reimbursement regardless of the patient's approval.
Okay. And I'm just curious because I recall from last month, we had some discussion about were these checks that were written by the insurance provider for the patient that were in his name, or were these other forms of income that were coming in as part of another veteran's benefit? Did we get that resolved?
I don't know 100% to that question, Jane. We can follow up on that one for you. My understanding, and I could be wrong when I say this, is that these were direct reimbursements from the third party liability agency. In this case, it would be the Veterans Administration to the individual directly. However, given state statutes, we are responsible for managing the finances and seeking reimbursement for services that we pay for where the patient is then reimbursed. But yeah, Jane, we'll verify that for you and figure that out.
Okay, thank you. Okay. And certainly the hospital needs to be compensated for the services that you're delivering.
Yeah. It's only for people that aren't indigent. For people that are indigent, the state pays the cost.
Yes.
Understood.
I just have a question, a little follow-up question on this. So what we're talking about here is income benefits to a patient that come from anywhere, but the hospital is attached to by the use of statutory authority, and patient's corporation is really a moot point. So I just wondered, does this go any further
It's hard to hear you, Chuck. You're coming in and out, like echoing.
Okay. Can you hear me better? Can you hear me better?
Maybe your speaker, but it's not, it's choppy. You can maybe try a headset.
The question I have is, if you find out that a patient has savings in the bank, in the stock market, any kind of assets, is the hospital by statutory authority able to attach those things and draw them away from the patient? That's my question.
You might want to get your headset. It was really, I think your essence of your question is, if they didn't get a check from a third party, but they had savings or other assets, could the hospital attach to those?
So that's a question I don't know the exact answer to. I think statute does essentially say if the individual has some type of income stream or any type of assets, the hospital has the right to seek reimbursement. I don't think it goes into details though, Dr. Goldstein, about specific asset classifications. But again, that's something that we can probably, we can follow up on in correlation to Jane's question a second ago regarding the specifics around that that payment process.
Okay, thank you. I did.
I'm just curious, should we make a motion? And the motion that I'm thinking of is that we be provided, the committee be provided with the rules and the process and the procedures around how patients' funds can be accessed for their bill at ASH, something along those lines.
I think we could make the motion and we can see what they can provide.
Okay, so I'd like to make that motion then. I'd like to understand how patients that are not indigent are responsible for their payment and how their funds can be accessed, what policies, what written policies and procedures are in place for that contingency.
I'll second that.
Okay, anyone opposed?
Lori, members, we have no problem providing that information to the committee. Lori, you may already have that though. You can access all of our policies. If you were to just look for like patient reimbursement or things like that, that will give you what you need to know. But we'll definitely take that back and make sure you all have what you need.
Okay, thank you. Okay, one thing that we skipped over, do we have any updates from any other IOCs? I kind of flew up by that on the agenda. Okay, hearing nothing. ASH administration update?
I don't have any major updates right now for the committee. I don't know if this will come up in the future in the future of this meeting. We did finalize the interagency services agreement or the ISA between the Department of Health Services and ADOA for the ombudsman position. So that's been finalized and signed off on. And we are right now working with Tim and Larry and Sarah to make sure that Sarah has all the information that she needs to move forward with this new position. And I want to just give a quick thanks to ADOA, to the procurement team at the Department of Health Services, and to the committee here, the IOC committee, for their patience as we work that the legalities of this situation. And I think that moving forward, we're in a great position where Sarah can have access to the information and be that independent voice that the legislature and the governor's office asked to have present. So looking forward to this.
Great. Okay.
I also want to piggyback on what Mike said and let you all know that I did also meet with the chief compliance officer, and we have already started on the onboarding process. So everything is as he said it is.
Hopefully we'll see you at the next forums. I know there's one coming up for forensic and one coming up for civil. We do not have a civil and forensic forum report this month. I think that was a carryover typo. We did have patient visits with Melissa and Janina. Now, Melissa, like we said, is often a family matter. Janina, do you want to report on your visits? And, you know, try not to give the unit...
Yeah.
Or the patient name and try
yes.
to, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So on the civil side, we met with the patient, and the big issue is having variety or having options, I should say, you know, going to different groups, or having a little bit more downtime,
you know, to have time to process things that that they learn in groups, and of course having options regarding going to different groups, depending on their interest and so forth. The other issue was to get out more, to go to the gym, having more time to do sports. Apparently, the day room can become very loud, and they would like to have an alternative to spending time in the day room. For example, listening to music, to potentially have access to e-readers, versus going to the library and getting a book from there. And let's see. So basically that's the idea, having options. Yes.
Hey Janina, it's Mike.
Hi.
Without going into exact details, do you happen to know, was this individual that you spoke to, is this a long-term patient or a rather newer admission?
It was a newer admission.
A newer admission. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, the patient was focused on efficiency and more freedom. However, freedom of options, like I said, but monitored. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I think it's Tara. It was the same patient that brought up very thoughtful ways to kind of give privileges to patients,
yes,
that follow the rules and not have everyone lose privileges because one patient is doing behaviors that are dangerous to that one patient. So therefore everyone loses the privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to come up with a system.
Right.
Of identifying which patients,
right,
were a safety risk and which ones were okay.
Uh-huh. And then he brought an interesting topic, you know, to discharge some people from there. Basically, you know, patients that would qualify for, you know, like memory unit or Altex, or, you know, that would benefit from other level of care, if you will, or levels of care. So that's basically the, you know, yes, Laurie, you're right. They were trying to come up with a more efficient system, to facilitate those options, if you will.
Yeah.
Another issue that was brought up, that if somebody is getting a movie from the library, then everybody has to watch the same movie. I mean, I'm the messenger here.
So was there mm-hmm. any, I'm glad we went to Civil Campus. Was there any other interest of patients that saw you guys there that wanted to talk to you?
Well, I don't, I don't think that we did the right PR, so to speak. So maybe next time we can put a sign or something, or I don't know. You know, I'm sure that the interest is there, but they were not sure, the other patients were not sure what we were doing over there, so.
Maybe we can work with the hospital to talk about it more, encourage them, because years ago, we would spend a lot of time on the civil campus.
And I'm pretty sure that there's interest, but of course they did not know who we were. So yes, Tara.
In my experience, working with the civil patients is best to come early in the morning. By the time the afternoon is weaning, they're doing, for those that do want to participate in rehab, but more likely we open the dorms, their medication, and they want to have downtime. The civil hospital has a different patient population. And so theirs is a little bit different. So I always encourage to come in the morning. The morning is a very good time to come with them, because by the time the day is beginning to wean, they're weaning off too, and they like downtime. For those that are not participating in any type of group, they're in their beds and they are tired. And that's a comment about the movies. Some patients go get movies, and the staff on the units let the patients all watch each other's movie. So they try to get a consensus of what each person wants and then settle on a movie. They can't take multiple movies out of the library, because we teach patients responsibility, just like taking books out, or if you are in a public library. So the answer to those questions.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I would definitely would like to have more information on the civil units to, you know, as regarding their programming, their, you know, routine and so forth, because that will give me a little bit more perspective on how the civil units are set up.
Okay, maybe we can try to put a visit on the end of the civil forum, which isn't it coming up in May, Tara? April or May?
It's coming up in May. You're going to have one back to back. One to be civil the first week, and then the next week will be the forensic, which the times are changed as well as the date, the days.
What days are we looking at?
We're looking at the 22nd for the civil, and we're looking at the 28th for the forensic, and they'll be in the morning at 9 o'clock. One is on Wednesday, and I believe one is on Thursday.
Oh, okay. So May. Okay. Maybe I can take some time off. All right. So that's, that is on the civil side. Now on the forensic side, let's see. There were some issues brought up, that, it appears that the mailroom opens, patient mail. The phone. So I can go over these issues, and then we can discuss, or however you would like to do this. The phone operator is asking who is calling the patient, and that can be a potential HIPAA violation.
So, Janina, I actually wound up filing a grievance on that issue, and they've resolved it. They're not going to be asking for patient information anymore from the operators.
Okay.
Thanks.
That was a training issue on our part, and we apologize.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad that it was resolved. An issue was brought up, for patients to have options to do therapeutic things, like, for example, if somebody wakes up in the middle of the night and, you know, they can go to back to sleep, or, you know, to have the option to either use paints, water-based, acrylic, non-toxic paint in the day room versus the, you know, quote unquote, staring at the walls. So that would be, I think that would be a good idea to have some sort of therapeutic options, you know, for the patients to engage if they do wake up during the night. That you know, painting or whatever, or whatever other therapeutic things patients would like to do. So let's see, what else? They would like to, they would like to have a more, a better approach to groups that are teaching skills. Skills that are based on with a goal of reintegration in society, right, after they are being discharged from the hospital, because obviously, you know, being inpatient for a long time, you tend to lose some skills, like, you know, from socializing to technology to, you know, whatever life looks like these days. So I think that would be a good idea. Another issue that was presented, that the rules differ from unit to unit, and the request was to have a uniform rule, that another issue, not having enough staff on the unit, kind of piggybacking on that one, whenever a patient is on insulin, the second nurse that witnesses the insulin shot and the quantity, et cetera, runs late, which interferes with meals and also with the long-acting insulin. Some patients would like to have their photos retaken so that friends can access their photos and see, you know, in real time, so to speak, how they're aging or how they're doing. Let's see, what else? Yes?
I think, if I'm, and maybe things have changed, but it used to be that the hospital had someone that would take photos of the patients and send photos to family members so they could see, or their family's kids or others. And then this was probably 2 years ago, maybe longer. I remember working on this with Ashley, but there was a policy change, and now the hospital no longer takes photos. Is that still the case, or are we back to taking photos?
I'm not 100% sure, Lori. I know I've had multiple requests when patients get visits, if the friend or family member, the loved one, can bring in a camera to take a photo with the patient, and I've never denied that request, but I'm not familiar. I'm not aware that we're taking photos and sending them to the recipient. I don't know, Trevor, Dr. Kuo, are you aware of that at all?
So my understanding is that rehab used to take pictures for us, and then we would be able to send them to family members. They no longer do that because they believe that that's a HIPAA violation. So the workaround the hospital has done for us is that, like, when we get a special visit, they can bring in a camera and take pictures of us or us with them, or however we want to take the pictures, and then forward that picture that way.
Okay.
One other issue that was brought up is socializing. So there's a limited time to socialize with peers and so forth, besides the groups. I think actually this makes a good point, you know, particularly if we're looking at the reintegration, right? So teaching some social etiquette or like I said, social skills or whatever, you know, like monitored socializing, if you will, so that you know, people can make a smooth transition in society. Because if you only socialize during group time, that's not really socializing. It's basically participating in a group. So I think that would be a good idea. And then you know, more information on moving through different stages. I understand that there are different stages, and I will try to access the folder which has that information, but people would like to have a better understanding of how to move through these stages and what it takes. Let's see. I think this is pretty much it for now. I mean, you know, there are more. I have some more questions regarding, you know, conditional release and the you know, plea deals and so forth. And I know that we're gonna have an education session and so about that, but that will be a Janina question or questions. I would like to understand those topics better, if you will. But I do think that the socializing and you know, having patients learn how life looks like these days, because it's way different than even 3 years ago. I think that would be beneficial. And being an outpatient psychiatric provider, I see that sometimes that reintegration, if you will, fails some, you know, quite a bit. And I would prefer for that not to be the case.
One thing, Janina, I think, and on the hospital dashboard, they have, I think they provide how many outpatient teams participate in the treatment meetings and ITPs and staffings.
Yeah.
As I know, even historically, a lot of times when people move from the community into the hospital, the teams are kind of hands off and often don't participate until they're ready to reintegrate.
Right. And, you know, I would like to have you know, a more hands-on sort of approach, if you will. Yes, Mike.
Yeah, hey, I just want to just reinforce what Lori just mentioned, and that situation becomes even more of an issue on the forensic campus, because forensic patients lose all Medicare and Medicaid eligibility through the state. So the outpatient teams are really not inclined to participate until the individual is nearing sentence expiration, or they're proceeding through the levels to the point where we are looking at conditional release. So it can be difficult to get us to have that level of engagement.
Well, I mean, you know, we can look into this and see what would be that bridge between inpatient and outpatient transition, you know, and what can be done better. I mean, obviously, I don't have the answer right now, and I'm not asking Mike to have an answer right now. You know, it's just something that I would like to, you know, work with you on, you know, more so that we can make patients successful. Yes, Alice. Alice, yes. Alice, do you have your hands up? Alice? Okay.
Lori, can you hear me?
Yes.
I have a question on this. I believe it was Kay who mentioned that she thought the taking of photographs was stopped because of a HIPAA concern. But
it's when the staff takes pictures of us and then sends them out to our families on our behalf that it might be a HIPAA issue.
But it isn't. I can definitively tell you that any piece.
Chuck, you've gotten muted again.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? Yeah.
Yeah.
Any piece of medical information can be released if the person who the medical information is about gives permission for that medical information to be dispersed to another person.
That's right. And the hospital wasn't having assigned paperwork for that. They were doing that basically kind of as a courtesy to the patient. They didn't go through the legal route of making sure that it didn't violate HIPAA and stuff. So they just stopped doing it because they just didn't want to deal with the paperwork aspects of it, I'm assuming.
Let me take this back internally. If there's a demand and a genuine need to do this, and we can have all of the appropriate paperwork on file to make sure that we're not violating any kind of confidentiality agreements. I have no problem doing this. I just want to make sure that this is not something where patients are just lining up with the staff asking for photos all the time. If we could come to some kind of agreement where maybe, you know, once a year we'll do something for the patients or something like that, but it can be incredibly burdensome. So let's figure out how to work this out.
It was during Christmas only, I believe, in the past. Christmas only. Yeah, there are Christmas photos.
Yeah, and that's something that I think can be managed.
Okay. And then really quick while I still have the mic, so about the packages, like I don't understand, I guess, legally how the mailroom can open our packages on our behalf. I mean, I couldn't go to your doorstep and just start opening your mail. And so I don't know, because this is our doorstep effectively, like how is it that they're able to open our packages legally?
So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to respectfully ask that the IOC allows me to send the information, the written information to Lori and ADOA specific to the hospital's ability to screen patient I'm sorry, excuse me, to screen patient belongings and properties for safety and security. I don't have that exact regulation off the top of my head, but we'll definitely get that to the IOC. I don't need it. I don't need a motion from the group. We'll do that.
Okay, that sounds good. I don't mind that the items are screened once we open the package, but it should be that we get to open our mail. Do you know what I'm saying? And then if they want to look at the contents of what we opened, I think that that's okay. But they're opening our mail at this point.
I'll get you all the definitions.
Yeah.
May I make a suggestion? Sorry that I'm so focused on reintegration because I'm on the other side of maybe having some specific groups, like for example, if you have groups on technology or I don't know, like whatever patient's career is based on, you know, figuring out a way to help them kind of get up to speed in that area so that they can be successful in obtaining a job when they get discharged.
No, 100%, Janita. So you know, we've had ongoing conversations in this group and then internally at the hospital. The patients are well aware that we are revamping our therapeutic work program. More details on that will be coming out fairly shortly about the approach we're going to take. Actually, Janina, if it's okay with you, I'd like to have a side conversation with you about potential
yes.
opportunities between the hospital and COPA.
Yes, yes.
I think COPA has some employee, I forget the exact term you all use, but it's like some employee supportive services or something like that. Where you
We have Voc Rehab. Absolutely.
Exactly. That I think there may be an opportunity for us
yep.
to partner up and solve the issue at least on a minimal level, if not
yeah.
more globally.
I love that idea.
Yeah. And they absolutely. Have a really, really, really strong lead that's leading that. That's in that effort now.
Yeah.
He would be awesome.
Yeah, and Mike, even like classes in social etiquette. You know, because being in an institution, right, for years and years, some you know, yes, you can interact with your peers and so forth, but interacting in real life is a completely different story, and you know. I think that patients would benefit from that, even if it's just like, you know, basic stuff. Mike, I would totally love to have a side conversation with you and let's make things better.
Okay, let's do it. I'll shoot you an email and I'll CC Lori and we'll set something up.
Awesome.
Okay, really quickly though, we do have a social skills group here. It is only by treatment team recommendation. And then there's also, we have like outside socials where we can interact with other units and stuff of that nature. There's different varying degrees of like social, like etiquette and social like interactions that we do get. And there are groups for that.
I think what would be probably more needed would be if they could look at what's changed since. People have been in there 10 years from now, they may not know that a lot of places are cashless. They may not know how to call a Waymo, how to call an Uber. They may not know a lot of things that have changed with society and technology. I think that would be more useful.
That would be a great group.
Yes. That's what I'm talking about, Kay, because like Waymo, I would never get into a car like that, but personally, but you know, I mean, it's a thing, you know, so, people should be kept up to date with, what's going on with the outside world.
Okay. Now Alice has a question. Her mic, isn't working. And to Janina's point, she wants to know if any other states have reintegration models for forensic patients with any known levels of success that we can draw upon.
I don't have the answer for that, but I can do the research.
So in the last meeting that this group had, maybe I'm not sure if it was the March meeting or the February meeting, but we had a conversation about the forensic campus, the resolution group. Someone on this committee, I forget who it was, I apologize, asked if that was like a commonality to have happen or to take place. We did reach out to our our partner state hospitals across the country, and many of them did respond back by saying they do offer something similar, and it is part of the reintegration process. They may not call it resolution group, but it mm-hmm. does. But what they offer does hit the same key topic points mm-hmm. and things of emphasis that ours does as well. So right. I think there is a general commonality across the board. But you know, clearly, you know, we'll do what we can to help out, and I definitely want recommendations and feedback.
Yes, and what I'm thinking, since I'm an ACT provider, I think that if we kind of provide some sort of model in the inpatient setting that can be that patients can transition to the ACT team. But anyways, we'll have that side conversation. I have a lot of ideas, so I don't want to take too much time.
Okay. Anything else from the visits before we go on to some incident and accident reports, and then we'll start our educational portion?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay. Okay. So you don't have to look at the side of my head while I'm reading incident and accident reports. I'm going to turn my camera off briefly. So let's start with ASH 2025-0672. This was an incident where a person, even though they had a one-to-one, was still trying to self-harm, and the patient grabbed the bottle of hand sanitizer and drank it. I think they did call poison control and do what they needed to do. And they did talk about the person's treatment and another recent ANC level from, I don't know what that means, ANC level, but that was in the report. But they're trying to redirect the patient. And the lessons learned was tell the staff to not have their small hand sanitizers or any other staff items out of their possession, and keep it out of the reach of patients. So this must have been a staff's sanitizer that was left unguarded, even with a one-on-one, to where the patient then swallowed the contents of it. So, Mike, what does ANC mean?
Hemoglobin A1C is a blood test that measures average blood sugar over the last 3 months.
I thought that's A1C. Is that ANC, Apple, Nancy, Charlie?
I'm not, it sounded like A1C. ANC okay. is absolute neutrophil count. And then okay. that's in regards to like clozapine use. And if it's low, then there could be neutropenia and higher infection risk.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the next one is ASH 2025-0686. And this one, a patient was told that they were now ROU, restricted to unit, because the patient was refusing medications. And staff was trying to get the patient up to take their meds. They were not successful. And then because the patient didn't take their meds and was refusing meds, their food visit got canceled, which then, you know, obviously the person was not happy about. And the nurse educated the patient that refusing psych meds is against the unit rules. Therefore, the food visit was canceled due to safety risk of them not being self-medicated. So on this, was a patient court ordered to take meds but just chose not to, therefore had a consequence, where the patient was not court ordered to take meds and was able to choose to either take the meds and have their visit or not take their meds and not have their visit? Because I thought most civil patients were more likely to be court ordered.
I don't know the specifics on this patient, Lori, so I can definitely look it up and get back to you directly. But it really does vary. Most patients have some type of court order regarding medications, which allow us to do a medication treatment plan with them so that if they refuse, we can give them other meds like IM medication so they get the medications that they need. But it is a safety risk, and part of treatment is learning how to become medication compliant. So we can look up the details on the specific patients to let you know.
Okay, thank you. Next one's Ash 2025-0705. Patient was assaultive, and in the notes later from the nursing, I just had a question on patient has a DASA, D as in dog, A as in apple, S as in Sam, A as in apple score of 2. For impulsivity and sensitivity to perceived provocation resulting in physical aggression towards others. I hadn't heard of that. So on that kind of score, is 1 good or is 10 good? Or what is the DASA score?
I'm going to let Trevor take this. This is Trevor's baby.
Okay.
I don't know if it's my baby, but yeah, so the DASA is an evidence-based screening tool that helps to measure for potential aggressive outbursts. And so the lower you score on this assessment, the less likely you are to be aggressive. It's on a scale of 1 to 7. And so 2 is relatively low in this case.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. Next one was Ash 2025-0739. This was an unwitnessed fall. And when the patient fell, they didn't let the nursing know or let staff know at all. When they went to, I think when they told the rider about it, then they called the nurse practitioner, they reported the fall, they did an assessment. And then they called the medical provider who also ordered them to be sent for an x-ray. Looking at it, it looked like this patient, I'm not sure if they had been assessed as a high fall risk or not. It didn't say that I saw, but it does say that the patient has been observed to have multiple blankets because it's cold, very cold at night. But blankets and multiple blankets are a hazard for tripping in the middle of the night. So what do you do? I mean, if someone is cold and they need blankets, but blankets are a fall risk, what do they do to keep the patient comfortable but yet safe?
Yeah, it is one of those tricky dilemmas that I think every hospital is constantly trying to figure out how to properly manage. We constantly check our AC to make sure that it's, you know, at the right temperature so it's not too hot or not too cold. At the time of this fall, this patient was not a high fall risk, but we are currently doing a deeper dive investigation into this known as a root cause analysis to see if there's something we could have done potentially to prevent this.
Okay. The next one, Ash 2025-0771. This one was a code white, which means using an object as a potential weapon, or the patient struck themselves with a Bible. My only question here is, I hope that this doesn't result in no one getting a Bible again, with one patient acting out and then having rules. I don't know what you do. Maybe get a soft cover. I don't know. But that was a new one.
We do not punish the units for one patient's behavior. So patients still have access. And I'm pretty sure this patient still has access to a Bible as well. But it was removed from this individual. And then the treatment team assessed to determine when it's acceptable for that individual to have it back.
Okay. Now, the next one is Ash 2025-0971. This was an AWOL attempt. Basically, a person was ROU'd and wouldn't allow someone. The patient was unhappy about it. and they were acting out. What happened is, and I'm not sure how this happened, because I've been on the units where there are kind of double layers of failure. There's the doors, and then there's the secondary doors, but apparently a BHT opened the door to the unit, and the patient ran out onto the mall, and then the patient ran towards the lobby, and this was civil, so jumping the gates, but they couldn't get out. They couldn't get into the lobby. They could just get over that first interior fence. But again, so the patient was never at risk for leaving the premises. They didn't even get out of the civil lobby. They never got into the civil lobby. But for this, I wondered how, when this patient was acting up, how they were out close to the doors that even leave the unit to the mall, unless they were out in that middle area.
I think what happened, Lori, is, and Trevor can maybe speak to this better than I can, is that on the exterior, not the exterior, but on the primary door entryway into the unit from the mall, that door has an ADA compliant push button that props the door open. And I believe the staff used that. So the door was kind of being propped open electronically. And then the individual opened the door to go into the day room of the unit, and the patient ran out that way.
Okay. Well, luckily they didn't get into the civil lobby.
Yeah, no, they were completely within the secure perimeter at all times.
Okay, we only have a few more to our honored guests that are now in. We'll make these last ones fast. Ash 2025-0992, a patient that was off on a visit at Valleywise for a GI visit. After they came back, then they were reporting pain, but they didn't want to tell anyone or didn't report it to the same GI visit that they were at. And then escalated and swallowed batteries. So then at that point had to end up going back to the hospital, back to Valleywise, which seems so not logical to me. They were at a GI visit. You would think that they would have mentioned it, but they ended up going back. So hopefully they got the batteries out in a GI consult. But yeah, that was a little unusual. And I think this one, Ash 2025-1032, there was an issue. Patient ended up causing injuries to staff. And at that point, the staff, I'm trying to read real quick whether it was a registry staff or a regular staff, but the staff did call the police. The police did come. The patient was escorted to the lobby where the police officers then handcuffed the patient for assaulting a behavioral health tech staff manager and escorted out. From my understanding is usually you send someone, or at least you do a handoff so they know about the patient and their meds and everything else. In this one, it seems like the nursing staff, the security staff inhibited the nursing staff from gathering the necessary information, saying it's my scene. So preventing them from giving information. That was unusual.
It was, and it has been addressed, but all of the patient's information was given to PD before they departed and took the patient to the Valleywise.
Okay.
So I want to add to this. This was a situation where we needed to redefine where the clinical team's effort stops and this becomes a law enforcement issue. So if Phoenix PD is on site to do an investigation or to potentially take an individual into custody, that becomes a law enforcement issue, and our clinical team needs to essentially step down and let law enforcement do their job and not inhibit or be a barrier to law enforcement moving forward. At this point, the clinical team was laser focused on making sure that the patient in question was being safe and being taken care of for properly. But that kind of conflicted with law enforcement being able to initiate the arrest and move forward. So we have spoken to all the individuals involved to make sure that they understand that there's a very fine line right there, so that they are responding correctly and engaging as appropriate with law enforcement so that they can do their job.
Thanks, Mike. The last one was Ash 2025-1035, and this is damage to or loss of property to the state, and also patient refusing treatment, threatening staff. A patient was escalating, hitting, kicking walls and doors, kicking the med door, and they refusing to speak. But what piqued my interest is they walked over to the patio door and kicked the door until it opened and went outside. To me, I thought the doors really shut tight. I mean, when I've been in there and heard the door slam in day rooms or other places, they don't close lightly. So was this a broken door that was able to be kicked open?
I don't believe it was broken. There are different lock sets in the hospital, and the door that goes to the patio is not like a deadbolt. So if you were to kick it repeatedly, it could retract and allow you to exit.
Okay. So committee, any questions on any of the incidents I brought up? Okay, our next section is going to be on an educational session. What I want to say loud and clear, so it's not about one person's individual case. We're not diving into one person. We're trying to understand guilty, accept, and sane, where the intersection of law, psychiatry, and public safety. Now, we have the pleasure of Dr. Potts, who's a forensic psychiatrist and does a lot of work for our state and many others. Holly Giesel, who is a lawyer that specializes in this area of law. Josh could not make it tonight and says he doesn't specialize in the forensic law, but more in civil law. So with that, again, this is about general cases. It's about who gets a GEI plea, what it means to take a plea, and Holly can talk about the legal side, and Jack can talk about the forensic side, and maybe even what you've seen in your few years of practicing. Has it changed, and is it different? Does it matter from the outlying rural counties versus Maricopa? Have you seen changes that are unique to Arizona versus other places? Anything you want to throw in there? And again, for the other patients and other members, not one specific case, in general. So I'll open it up.
Hello, do you want me to just give a quick presentation?
Sure.
Okay. I'm a physician. I'm Dr. Jack Potts. I've been involved in the forensic psychiatry, and forensics is simply, I don't want to be presumptuous, but simply the application of medical or scientific knowledge to the resolution of legal conflicts. So you can have forensic accountants, forensic pathologists, forensic psychiatrists, forensic engineers. So I'm a forensic psychiatrist. I was involved on the committee that wrote this law many years ago, and the law was in reaction to, there were some changes, but the law essentially, and this happened nationally, was in reaction in part to John Hinckley's attempted assassination, I believe it was Ronald Reagan. Up until that point, in most places, around that point at least, insanity was not an affirmative defense. If you said you were insane, your lawyer said someone was insane, didn't have the ability to know right from wrong, et cetera, et cetera. The state had to prove that you were not insane. So the burden of proof was on the state, the prosecutor. After Hinckley and other cases, essentially changed where it became an affirmative defense, where the burden was then on the defendant to prove that he or she was not in the right state of mind or met the standard for insanity. And insanity, again, it has nothing to do with medical diagnoses. In the sense that it's a legal term, it's a forensic, a legal term defined in the law. You do not see it when you look at the DSM-5 or 4 or any of them. And it goes back to English law and law way before that, but to McNaughton was the most common case reference in our common law. Anyway, State Senator Patty Noland, as my recollection, chaired the committee that I happened to be on with members of defense and the bar and victims. And it was then they would not accept the not guilty reason insanity term, so I used the guilty except insane, which was somewhat unique in the country. It was affirmative, therefore you had to prove that you met the legal criteria, and that's very well defined. You have to have a mental disorder, and it can't be secondary, just acute intoxication. So you have to have a disorder, not know the wrongfulness of your behavior. And I can go into some of the technical details regarding the different standards, but I will also let you know that some states do not have insanity as an option. Montana, I still believe, does not have that, and it is not a U.S. constitutional requirement that insanity be allowed as a defense. There's other defenses that can, as you all know about, self-defense is a legal defense to harming someone. There's other legal defenses, involuntary intoxication, maybe you took some medications or you were poisoned, a lot of different legal defenses. Anyway, one of the issues we noted, there was not a large uptick in insanity acquittees. And insanity acquittees, those who are, let's say, acquitted, even though it's not a correct term, by insanity, saying that they're insane at the time of the offense, is very rare. And when we first started, Maricopa County did the right thing, and they refused to accept plea agreements, because when we wrote the statute, the full intention was that there would be no plea agreements, that everything would be either submitted to the court as a trier of fact or have a jury trial, that you could not get you could not do a plea agreement where you just say, you know, just say a guilty plea and plea agreement was not permitted. I don't know if that's changed. I think it has in Maricopa, but other counties were doing it willy-nilly, which I believe has contributed to many problems, because the law we wrote said there will be the trier of fact, and I guess there should have been more clarification on that, because we thought that you don't want to have defense attorneys saying, oh, it's an easy way I can get this my client to the hospital, they don't have to go to prison. And the prosecutor saying, yep, I can get them off the streets, and that's an easy way of doing it. We didn't want a lot of people going to the state hospital who really didn't need to be there or deserve to be there because of the state of mind. I will be open, Ms. Goldstein, I will be open to questions, whatever you want, however you want to do it. I just want to give people a basic background of my experience in this going back many decades, and some of the people here don't know that my office, for a decade, I was the head of forensic services for the Superior Court here in Maricopa County. And so my office was, in fact, in the courthouse. So So does that give you a little background? I mean, I could go over I could read what the standard is, but I think people know it and they don't, unless you want me to do so, I will.
Well, I think we may have more questions. So what's the intention if someone, again, you just explained some states have it, some states don't. Was it the intention of someone, typically these are reserved for serious crimes, right? Not misdemeanors or speeding. So was it the intention that if someone had some serious charge and they were going to be sentenced 10 years or 20 years in prison, was it the intention that this person is sick and therefore doesn't need punishment, needs treatment, and should serve that time in a therapeutic setting? And that was kind of the overall plan?
Yeah, well, there's two things. One is it's intended for any offenses. And that's why if it is a non-dangerous offense or lack of hurting someone or serious threat of physical injury, then there's a separate procedure. So you can have people in for burglaries, other cases where they will be insane. The intent initially was that this is a different class of people who really aren't the same who do crimes or act in passion. They're people who maybe like McNaughton was, or deluded and believe they're doing the right thing sometimes. And you know, I met many of your patients there who believe that what they were doing at the time was absolutely right. And they still may believe that what they were doing was saving society or saving a child or some sort of child abuse ring, et cetera. So the people, society in general said, we should not treat these people the same as we treat someone who's going to go and murder someone for profit or gain or drugs. So, and yes, the answer is society said we should place these people where they get treatment because they're a different kettle of fish. They're a different breed of cat, or using anything you want to say. They're people who just should be treated differently because they are different. Just like we treat juveniles differently. You know, we have laws and restrictions. So we say, hey, we should not put them with the general criminals or the best people who make mistakes. I mean, my experience in the jail for 15 years was that most people there are decent people who simply make mistakes. And they have to get punished for them if they're bad enough.
Was the goal to be sentenced to ASH or to be treated, rehabilitated, and reintegrated into society? Because some people are under the belief that we're sentenced to ASH for the total duration of our sentence, and I would like some elaboration on that.
Well, no, clearly the goal was to have people in a treatment program where they could be released to the community and community supervision. And that's written in the statute. It's very clear. But one of the primary goals, the primary goal even back then, was that the safety of the community is paramount, that people not be released and get out and harm and do other things. And you've had some catastrophic problems with that. Just a couple, as was mentioned, a couple bad cases make for bad law and people changing policies and procedures because they had one bad mistake by someone. That shouldn't happen. No, you are, and the law has changed slowly. The prosecutors essentially have had more input, and they always do in our state, the Arizona Prosecuting Attorney's Advisory Council. They have more input into changing the law, and they've made it a little more with a little more of an intent to keep people in the hospital, is my opinion. And that means in an institution. The goal is, number one, to treat people in a secure environment so that, because you have some serious victims. So that's the goal. And number two is to release them in the community. And we try to pattern it a little bit on the Oregon statute with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. But the reality is, yeah, they should go. People should be released into the community. The state hospital, on a number of times, I think, has done what is absolutely unethical by making policy, not individualized treatment, which I think the Supreme Court says you have to have in psychiatric facilities, and there's case law on that, but and based on our Constitution. But what I believe is previously they said, well, you have to serve at least two-thirds of your time in the facility before we're going to be considered for release. I think that's blatantly unethical. It's for medical clinical people to say that. If it's part of the statute, then they have no choice, but it's not part of the statute. The statute says when someone's in stable remission and they're not dangerous to community, they should be released into community.
Laurie, I just want to say I have a number of disagreements with Dr. Potts based on what the current law says. I'll hold that. But I just want to make that clear because I don't want the current law, since we switched from 1993 from not guilty by reason of insanity to guilty except insane, the prosecutors, the AAPC and none of the prosecutors have ever run a statute to change Arizona's GEI law. 13502, 13997, 3994, etc. The only change to the original law came about by Nancy Bartow, a public defender, and me. And that's the only amendment to the statute, and we changed it fundamentally. So I want to be clear. Dr. Potts has given a phenomenally good overview of the evolution of the insanity defense in the United States. Arizona has a very different GEI law, and it came about specifically because of abuses under the not guilty, except not guilty by reason of insanity, because two very prominent families lost loved ones, and very good defense lawyers got the person off entirely. And he murdered his wife, and he was back on the golf course shortly thereafter. His defense was that she was a Jewish American princess who was too demanding and drove him to kill her because she was so materialistic.
And, I remember that case.
Yeah. And so that's how we lost not guilty by reason of insanity, and we transitioned to guilty except insane, and the current law requiring commitment to the Arizona State Hospital was implemented. So I want to just put that in because I don't want patients to be confused about what the current statute says and the fact that you currently are committed to the Arizona State Hospital for your presumptive sentence. Now, there are some important issues there, and I'll come back to that, but I just want to cue the patients. Please don't hang up and say, okay, I have the answer, and the prosecutors are the ones that caused the law to be what it is. We have more changes planned in this law, and we're going to make it more just, more science-based, more evidence-based, and we're going to preclude some of the practices that undermine the current statutory intent. Now, I'm going to be quiet.
Now, the point being, you are sentenced to the jurisdiction of the state hospital for the presumptive sentence. And the court now has authority over that for the presumptive sentence. The problem is most people could, if it's a first offense, would have pled to a lesser offense and or got a mitigated sentence. So some people I know have been sentenced to the state hospital for 7 years, when in fact they would have gotten 3.5 years probably at Arizona Department of Corrections. And that's clear, that's an issue, but that's just facts, just life.
And I agree with that, and that's because of the defense lawyers who told them erroneously that if you go to the Arizona State Hospital, they'll have to let you out in 120 days if you're in stable remission. I have heard that. I have a list of five clients who have been told that. That is absolutely untrue. They mix up somehow. They came up with 120 days, and some defense lawyers say that. In fact, the statute says you can't have a hearing of any kind for 120 days. And so there are a plethora of urban myths about our GEI statute that simply are untrue. And I'll come back to that.
Can we take questions? Any more questions for me?
Yeah.
Well, either of us.
Dr. Potts, do you have a percentage of people who get off by that? I mean, who are returned to the community?
What do you mean returned to the community? When?
If they've been guilty but insane, and it's determined that they're not, and Dr. Potts was saying that they're supposed to be rehabilitated to be able to return to the community. How many of those, you know, what percentage of people do return? Do you know?
No, the state hospital has that. In fact, the law requires that the state hospital and PSRB, or I don't know about PSRB anymore, but that they keep records. Back when they first started, the first 4 or 5 years, there were probably 30 or 40 people, a large percent, that were on community release. Now, that could have been at the hospital, at that facility, but it was a fairly good percent back then from my last records, but I haven't looked at it, who they were released to the community under community supervision. I don't know what number or what percent or how frequently that happens now.
Okay.
I think there's some problems.
Yeah. It depends on, and Barb, the number is going to depend on the length of the presumptive sentence. I've had two people leave.
Huh.
They are no longer, they serve their time and they are out. I have others that were going to get out for other reasons. So yeah, I have a guy who did one term for first degree murder, one term for aggravated assault, was not competent, not restorable, was restored. Yuma County did an excellent job. He came to Ash, he served his commitment sentence, and he left. I have another in forensic who left. She served her sentence, served her commitment. She's in a behavioral health residential facility in Maricopa County. She's about to transition. I just talked to her today. She's transitioning. She got good treatment, and she's going to another home in another county, and she's going to do well. I've had two other patients who serve commitment terms, they're both under the prior administration. So plenty of people serve their commitment terms. Whether they got treatment or not is a different issue. It's not something I can comment on, you know, tonight. But any other questions? Or I want to really make sure that some of the patients understand the law.
One thing I think, so some patients think that, or they were told, now, you know, like I told you, I got different answers from other judges I know that say whenever there's a plea change, they painstakingly explain, has anyone promised you anything other than what I'm reading to you right now, that you are agreeing that you're guilty except insane, that you're going to this presumptive sentence of 15 years, and they say, no one's promised me anything. And then they get to Ash and say, well, my lawyer said I would be out. I'm so stable, I would be out in 120 days or be out in a year.
But Lori, that's an accurate answer. And it's not an incorrect answer. What, and I believe I've done, last week I did four pleas. There is no painstaking explanation of anything. They ask questions in machine gun fashion. Did anyone promise you anything to get you to take this plea? No. Did anyone threaten you or force you or coerce you to take this plea? No. There is not a question. What did your lawyer tell you? There is not a question. How long did your lawyer tell you you would serve? There isn't a question. What have you been told is the length of time that you might spend at ASH? That is never asked. Never. N-E-V-E-R. Never. So there is a big difference in saying, has anyone
promised you anything? Yeah.
Yeah. The question that you ask, the answer is very different. That's a different question than what is asked. So I go through, it's called a plea colloquy. I go through those weekly. Now,
so what is the option if someone believes that they're at ASH and now their jail time doesn't get counted because now they're in a hospital?
All right, we're talking about back time. All right, here's the answer to that. I've had 3 phone calls on this today, 11, 240, 310. Not all my patients. Here is the answer. You are sentenced to the presumptive sentence. You're committed to ASH under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court for the presumptive length of your sentence. That's like the mid-range. Your sentence can vary from super mitigated to super aggravated. So it might be 5 to 12 years. The midpoint might be 8. So presumptive, you'd be sentenced to that. A judge, if the judge chooses at the time of the sentence, can give you back time credit. So I have a couple of clients whose judges said the presumptive sentence is, let's say, for example, 5 years. You were in jail 2 to 2 years. I'm going to give you credit for 2 years, and your commitment to ASH is 3 years. If the judge does not do that, then the statute gives you, and that's not in the statute, but it's in the judicial discretion of a court when sentencing someone. I have never seen it happen in Maricopa County. I have seen it happen in out counties. If the judge does not do that, and every defense lawyer ought to be asking that they get time served, knocked off the presumptive sentence, then the only option that you have is that if you go, and we got this specifically in the current statute through amendment. If you go to ASH and ASH determines that you're no longer benefiting from treatment, you're in stable remission, but you remain dangerous, they can ask the court to send you to prison for the balance of your commitment. I've had one of these cases in the past year or so. In that case, we had that happen not too infrequently under the PSRB. Thank blessed mother, they're gone. And we said, wait a minute, if somebody had gone to prison originally, they would have gotten their back time. So it doesn't make sense that now they're going to prison for the balance of their commitment, that they don't get back time. So if you've been at ASH and ASH succeeds in asking the Superior Court, the same Superior Court that sentenced you, to send you to prison because they can't help you anymore and you remain dangerous, then you get credit for your back time. I can argue both sides of that case. Do I think it's in the public's interest that somebody who's sat in jail with no treatment for a year or 2 years, 3 years, goes to ASH and is committed for say 5 or 6, doesn't get effective treatment there, and then is sent to prison with credit for time served, all we're doing is letting somebody get out early with no treatment anywhere. But my job is not, when I'm representing an individual client, public policy is not my job. The client is my job. But if I'm drafting legislation and if I can, we're talking, a group of us, about going back and making some additional changes. But that's the only way you get credit for time served, is either you ask the judge when you are sentenced to reduce the presumptive sentence to the amount of time you served in jail. And, you know, sometimes, particularly in our current community-based behavioral health system, we all know this, you may have incomplete, non-compliant, non-adherent medication, medication history. So you're in a psychotic break. You are insane at the time, which is to say, under 13502, you have a mental disorder, a mental illness of such magnitude that you don't know what you're doing is wrong. You think you're slaying a dragon. You don't know that the dragon is your mother. So, in that circumstance, you get sentenced for that presumptive length of time. And hopefully, while you're in jail, you get put back on your medication. And if you refuse, you get a good lawyer who will go in and get you court-ordered on medication. And if necessary, if you are a danger to yourself or to others, they get a court order and they transfer you from jail to Valleywise if you're in Maricopa County, or to Banner University if you're in Pima, or to somewhere in other counties. If you're out county, you're out of luck, basically. Out county equals out of luck. And you get treatment. And we do that routinely, and we do it successfully, until we got one guy transferred recently, and he hopped the fence and escaped from Valleywise, which is now given the judges in Maricopa County a sour taste in their mouth a bit, understandably. Nobody wants to be the judge who released somebody who hopped the fence at Valleywise and then disappeared for 2 months.
So, Holly,
so that's on, that.
On that. Yeah, on that point, I think that last year it seemed like a group of patients that got out, some of which failed for various reasons, most reasons drug use, not due to mental illness. Again, I don't know if all of them, I'm just in general. So when that happens and they get back, the judges now seem, in the Superior Court, aren't believing the risk assessments, and they want a lot more, which makes sense because public safety is their, it's their 100%. Duty to ensure public safety.
100%.
So now, yeah. Now the patients are upset because they're more hesitant. And I said, but that's the way it works, you know.
Well, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. If I could say to my clients individually and to their parents, their guardians, their brothers, their sisters, their aunties, their uncles, you do yourself and no, but you don't do your loved ones any favor in hiring a lawyer and paying them $100,000 to push and get you out in half the time that a very carefully orchestrated, carefully conducted procedure initially determined that you should be committed. Now, we have known since at least 19, I don't know, Jack, when was Olmstead? I can't remember, 90-something. The most, you can't hold somebody without treatment in a locked setting just because they're mentally ill or disabled. And since then, the Ninth Circuit has nothing to do with Arnold v. Sarn. Since then, the Ninth Circuit has said you can't hold somebody in an emergency room in a psychiatric state without treating them. So you can hold them for a week or so as long as you're treating them, but you can't hold them forever without treating
them. Does Haldol count? That's a favorite, the ER med.
Well, sure, it's treatment. Now, does it treat, but you can't keep somebody on Haldol for months and expect them to get any better. I mean, unless that's what they need. And Dr. Potts can address that matter. I've seen lots of people in jail who got nothing but Haldol, and they were certainly a heck of a lot better off than when they were on the street on meth, not medicated with Haldol. So that's a clinical question.
I have a question for you, Holly, and this is where a lot of the patients, I guess, are kind of upset when they take their pleas, because under 13-3994, section B, number 3, it says, if the court finds that the person still has a mental disease or defect, or that mental disease or defect is in stable remission, but the person is no longer dangerous, the court shall order the person's conditional release.
Yes.
The person shall remain under the court's jurisdiction, because we've been sentenced not to Ash per se, but to the jurisdiction of the Superior Court.
Yeah. You're not sentenced to Ash. You're committed.
Yes. And then a conditional release means release from a secure mental health facility under written specified conditions. And that's ARS 13-3991. And I think a lot of us take these pleas because, like, the presumptive winds up being a lot longer than what we would have had we gone to prison. So we're effectively getting punished longer for being mentally ill at the time of our crime.
Yeah, thinking
that we're gonna get conditionally released, because a lot of us have met the criteria of being in stable, and if not, some of us in full remission, and not dangerous, and we're still sitting here for years. It's not just willy-nilly, like 1 or 6 months or a year or even 2 years. I mean, some of us are going on, you know, a half a decade to a decade of just patiently waiting. A lot of us are first-time offenders, working professionals, like,
yes.
How do you, and the thing that's hard, and if I can make a suggestion to you, if you are changing the laws, is that there needs to be a time frame in which some of this stuff gets executed, because a lot of us wind up sentencing out before we actually ever get conditional.
You're 100% correct. The greatest failure in our GEI system is the lack of resources at ASH to hire enough competent professionals to provide treatment to meet the statutory objectives. Is that the basis for a lawsuit? Probably. But it's not, ASH can't print money. And Lord knows, as anybody, I mean, Michael Sheldon and I know each other well, I'm not saying that gratuitously, but Mike Sheldon can't go to, he doesn't have a debit card. The Arizona legislature and this governor and the Democratic Party in particular have abandoned the patients at ASH. The Department of Health Services has not once in the past 10 years asked for sufficient funding for ASH to do its job as it is envisioned under the statutes. And that is the defining difference between Arizona's GEI statute, Oregon and Connecticut, which each have PSRBs and have budgets for their PSRBs that were in the millions of dollars. Millions. The reason that we wanted to put it under the Superior Court is that the one thing you can count on with a judge is that if you make your case clearly and convincingly, which is the evidentiary standard, the judge can, and in my opinion, most of them will, order the hospital to do something. The biggest problem that the hospital has is the inadequate number of psychologists to do risk assessments. To have to wait 6 months on a 5-year sentence commitment to get a risk assessment is ridiculous.
Holly, can I ask you on this?
But you got to have money. Well,
Holly, a couple things. Number one, cannot the judge order the state hospital to provide a report within 45 days?
I think it's 30 days, yes.
Okay.
Nobody's, I've never had the reason to ask for that. And I'm not aware of, I'm sure Tammy Ray may have, but yeah, they can. Your lawyer's got to ask for it.
And so they've got to, let me just finish, please, my questions. number one, so they can do that, and that no matter what, ASH would have to comply with that by law. Secondly, if you look at the statute, a risk assessment isn't mandatory. It says if clinically indicated in the statute. Yes. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting issue. I just had someone from Pima County asking who does risk assessments up here, but that's another interesting issue. It should not be.
You just got to have a lawyer who gets a psychiatrist that will say it's clinically indicated.
But, but if it's not clinically indicated, they still can do a, they have to do a mental health report.
Yes, if I ask.
Order a mental health report.
Yes, and I can tell you.
Can I finish, please? Let me ask. I'm asking a question. If the court orders a mental health report in 45 days, it does not have to include a risk assessment. Is that accurate?
That's correct, but you're not giving a risk assessment. And the only clinically accepted way, as you know, Dr. Potts, that somebody can say to a reasonable degree of psychiatric probability whether somebody is safe is through a risk assessment.
Unless it's been done before, but there's a question I'll go back to about how many people get released. In the first 7 years, there were 110 GEI people.
Mm-hmm.
Of that, 41 were nonviolent. Okay.
Right.
I'm just helping that someone had a question earlier. Just gives, and then as of June, decades ago, there were 131 people. 24 of the 131 were released to the community, which is a large percentage. And 74 people out of that in the first 7.5 years had their sentence expired.
Yeah. Most people who are released into the community, not under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court or the OPSRB, I have never known anyone to be released other than expiration of their commitment. I have never. It is always you served your full commitment.
No, they just recently had about 6 or 8 last year, but of those, a bunch, and you can look at the numbers of discharges and admissions, but a lot of them failed and came back, or failed and went other places.
They were on levels 5 and 6. They were
exactly
definitely released.
Yeah, Lori, there is a difference. We've got to understand this. You can be conditionally released on phase 1, 2, 3, etc. Levels 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you can be living in the community full time with your family, alone, or under your clinic, but you are still under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court for the complete length of your commitment.
Okay.
So if you've got a 25-year commitment, it's going to be 25 years. If you've got a 4-year commitment, it's going to be 4. I've got maybe 1 or 2 people with 4 years. I've never had anybody who did not commit a violent crime go to ASH. And those are misdemeanors and other things, who were people who were maybe both not competent, not restorable, and insane at the time of GEI, at the time of the offense for which the GEI evaluation was done. Don't get that much in Maricopa. So it's very important. 1339.94 at SEC, you are going to remain conditional release in the community unless the court orders otherwise, or you serve the full term of your commitment.
Now, one thing, since the court, whether it was the court or the PSRB, they rely on treatment teams for their evaluation. And to me, again, having seen many people in psychiatric hospitals and see many people as they first present, they may be in that honeymoon phase, they may be acting psychotically, they may be better because they've been in jail a while, but and we have some clinicians on here, do we really think that someone gets to a new facility, they're settling in, they're learning the ropes, that you get a clear picture and assessment within 45 days of someone getting somewhere?
No, that's not a risk assessment, Lori.
No, I mean a clinical.
That's a mental health report. That's really almost like a checkup visit. And you can, I have had a client who had a mental health report in 45 days by a physician who said there are no active symptoms of mental illness. This patient was doing extremely well in the community. This patient self-surrendered. This patient did this or this patient did that. And the physician told me, frankly, this may be the first patient that I've had who is out of here in on one risk assessment, stable on medication, et cetera. That is rare, but it does happen. But it's important. The 30-day or 45-day report is not a risk assessment. It is a report to the court to say the patient was admitted. Here's what the patient's treatment plan is. I always ask the treatment team to provide that as an exhibit because they will have at least their initial individualized treatment plan. The hospital is really good, in my experience, about getting that ITTP done, the initial one, whether it's detailed or not, or whether it's truly individualized, we can argue about, but they get it done. I've never had them not do it. And that's their job and they do it. What happens later is, again, in my opinion, because of lack of resources and culture, but money changes culture really fast. If you get 8 board certified forensic psychiatrists in there, you get psychiatric therapists, you do deep dives into trauma, you do deep dives into family of origin issues, you will have different results, but you're going to have to spend $100 million. You're going to have to fund at the level that other top-notch state psychiatric hospitals fund, and that's what I want.
And our state wants to cut.
I don't know. Yeah. Our state and the feds, although the feds aren't, but I am as frustrated as my clients, more so because they have one lawsuit. I have 21 clients or something. So when I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's to think 21 times about people that I can't get out, and some of whom ought to be out, some of whom shouldn't be out. But we need, the biggest thing that we could do to improve and speed up the timeliness and the thoroughness and the equity and fairness of what goes on for the patients at ASH is more resources and leadership to use those resources to fund it. That's what we need.
Well, we saw the report 2 years ago asking for drug specialists and trauma special informed care, and they got zero.
Right.
So again, people have to advocate down with our legislators. In our state, public safety is seen as number one.
Yeah. And in the behavioral health field, community-based treatment is seen as number 1.5 or 2.0. And I've never had a client who came to ASH who wasn't in our community-based treatment, and that treatment system failed them. They should not have escalated to the point. And then ineffective law enforcement, de-escalation, ineffective treatment when you're released, when you're arrested and you're not diverted and not referred to really top-notch community treatments. That's why we're near capacity at ASH. It's a system failure. It's not ASH's failure. So
I guess from a patient perspective, it's just very frustrating to be on a wait list for upwards of almost a year. I mean, July of last year was when I know we're not supposed to talk about statistics, but
you can talk about it. We can talk in general, but not in specific.
Okay. So I can speak to a numerous patients having to wait almost 9 months to a year to get a risk assessment.
Unacceptable.
And it's very frustrating. Yes, I think so too. And then that's just to get assigned a person. And then at that point, then the risk assessment proceeds, and that can take upwards from 3 to 6 more months. So,
yeah,
I mean, it's very, very slow moving. And by the time that a lot of people in here have like 10-year sentences and things, and they wind up sentencing out trying to get through the system because the system is just so bogged down.
I agree. And I think that I will go one step further because I've, you know, now been representing people, interacting with people for years. I believe that being in any locked facility without conditional release in the community on a supervised basis is harmful to the patient. I have seen my patients regress. I have seen them become sicker. And it is because they are not having the positive reinforcement and the therapeutic interventions that build on each other to improve and get to the stable remission and no longer dangerous. Drugs alone aren't going to do it. They may be 80% or 90%, depending on your view on the primary use of primary psychopharmacology as a treatment mode, and I favor that. But it isn't enough alone. And so I totally agree. Start to finish turnaround, you ought to be able to get a risk assessment. And in a private institution and in some state institutions, I can get it. Out of state, you could get it. You ought to start to finish data request to completion and report to your treatment team an evaluation by whatever depending on your hospital. The equivalent of the SCC should be no longer than 90 to 120 days, start to finish.
But that is someone that has a fully functioning staff. I think some of the risk assessments, since they didn't have enough psychology and psychologists, were done by interns, and they were then not accepted. And I think that some of the
that's only in Maricopa County. I've never had an out county. It's only one prosecutor. And the one in which I had it, they had no expert. And we said, where's your expert to say that that's not standard of care? And they essentially capitulated. But the only way to build to the kind of trajectory that we all want, a therapeutic trajectory to get you out of confinement, like Olmsted said, we can't just confine you in a restrictive setting when there's a less restrictive, clinically appropriate setting. The only way to do that is with residents and fellows and more psychologists. That's what happens. The fastest, best trajectory that I know of is in Connecticut. It is staffed by Yale New Haven Medical School, residents, attendings, and I use them as experts from time to time. But that's what you've got to do. You've got to have more bodies, and you've got to have psychiatrists who have the credentials and the chutzpah, if you will, to stand up and say, I want this done, and I want it done now, and here's my order, carry it out. I'm sure Dr. Goldstein, if he's on the phone, has done that in the emergency room when he's got patients backed up and he can't get an MRI.
You can only do that when you have staff and a fully functioning, you have enough staff. Again, it comes down to money, so you can...
100%. And my question for everybody, when we hear from the peers and we hear from the governing body and we hear from the Arizona Disability Law Center, they all say, oh, well, we need community-based care. We need this. We need that. Here's my question. Where is your bill to fund that? Where's the law that you drafted and asked the Arizona legislature to pass to fund that kind of community-based system? I have not seen one bill in 30 years from all the people who talk community-based care to give ASH the money that it needs to implement an inpatient psychiatric model that is consistent with Olmsted and Arnold V. Sarn. Where's the law? Where's your draft?
Okay, so what do patients that, you know, again, I think that systems rely on clinical teams to make assessments. Right. So they have, this is what we have in Arizona at this sure. time. We are funded to the level that our state wants to fund.
Right.
And that's the same with our universities and our state
right.
long-term psychiatric hospitals.
Our roads, our schools, yeah. everything.
Yeah.
The answer is you have to get your defense lawyer to get a private risk assessment. And not from somebody who's just going to tell you what you want them to tell you, because Ash will find the time to pick apart a bogus risk assessment. And if you're in Maricopa County, the prosecutors will. So get the defense lawyers need to get the risk assessments. And I've got some that are on that we've got to start pushing on more. Nobody does everything as fast and thorough as they want to. But the only way to help the patients, and this is going to sound odd, the patients can help Ash and the patient's lawyers can help Ash by getting really good risk assessments and pushing for those levels. And I've been, frankly, pretty impressed with the SCC of late. And we've had a patient ask to change the plan to add, you know, I mean, they've been responsive. They've looked at things carefully. And from what I can tell, Dr. Kuo is doing, stepped into a position, is leading. I thoroughly enjoyed having him as the psychiatrist for my clients, that he was thoughtful, he listened, he had a good balance between the psychopharmacology as the primary treatment at ASH and other issues. So I think that the patients, as part of recovery, as part of your therapy, is to become your best self-advocate. And I take calls all time on myself from every one of my clients. Make your lawyer do the same thing.
I think that's also where we're, as patients, we're running into issues, because the laws are there to protect us, but a lot of us have public defenders and they don't want to either read the laws, because there's just such a few, you know, the population here is maybe 120, and the public defenders that we get generally aren't experts in mental health either. And so, like, it's hard to get them to do an independent risk assessment, or they'll argue and say that it's stronger if it comes from ASH, or, you know, and so it's just a really difficult, I guess, thing to navigate. And had I
known, yes, it is.
And I think a lot of us feel this way too, is that, you know, we could have taken much lesser sentences if we would have just went to prison, and we're being almost punished for being mentally ill at the time, which is fully bad.
But we hear a lot of horror stories also from families. I mean, look at Crystal's son. Jails and prisons aren't, you know, a good time and perfect treatment either. So I think that to compare and wish for going to prison or jail, I don't know.
Well,
grass is always greener.
I would have known that we would have served the majority of our sentence here, or the duration of the presumptive, that right. it would have been good to know that at the time that we're making the decision. I don't know if I would have chosen prison, but I know that that would have been a much lesser sentence for me, like, because it was my first offense and things of that nature.
Right. Right. And you have, and, you know, with the first offense, no criminal history, no death. Okay. Death. If there's a murder involved, you got to put that in another whole bucket. We won't deal with that right now. If you've got an injury, a serious injury, anything that like causes bleeding or bruising or requires, you know, medical attention, etc. I think it is likely that many people who came to ASH with the expectation that they would be out certainly in 120 days, nobody, that's not going to happen. It's not possible. the only way you can get out is with a risk assessment and, and an order from the court, just like it was, you know, similar to PSRB. So I think you would have done less, quote unquote, time. Now, I think you wouldn't have gotten treatment in DOC, and you probably wouldn't even have gotten medication. It's gotten better in the last 2 years. But so I think that's also something that maybe mitigates the injustice, but it doesn't address your concern. There is another issue, and that is that if you got your back time, and if you leave ASH and you go to prison, because ASH says that you're still dangerous, if you have served your presumptive sentence, then you walk in and you walk out of DOC. And that is a strategy that may be appropriate in some cases.
But I think also,
do I want to advocate for somebody to leave prison, leave ASH and go to prison? Do I think that's a great idea? Not off the top of my head. However, I have talked to individuals before and after commitment where I can see that if they're going to sit and do the full presumptive sentence with no credit for back time, unless they go to ASH, then going to ASH may be the best answer. And I would certainly advocate for that. I'd file the petition.
Holly, this is Janina. Can I Can I make a few comments here?
Sure.
correct me,
Janina.
I'm not correcting you. I'm not here to correct anything. I'm here to just share my experience. as an ACT provider, I would like to say that I fight for my patients not to be in the justice system, period. Yes. Whether it's jail, prison, and so forth. The care in the prison system is absolutely egregious.
Yep.
Patients do not get medications. So, you know, yes, it can be frustrating waiting at ASH and so forth, but at least, you know, people get treatment because psychosis can cause brain damage.
Yes.
Long-term. And Dr. Potts, you can correct me here. And, you know, the longer a person is psychotic, the lower the chance of being restored to some sort of stability. We have to, so please understand that I fight with all I have for my patients to not go in jail and prison, and Holly can attest to that.
Yes.
You know, I have patients in prison that are not getting, that are on court order treatment, that are not getting the injections, they're not getting oral medications, and they're not getting anything. I had to go in, you know, to the jail to petition patients to get them out of there and get them treatment. And the coordination between outpatient and jail is absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
It's poor at best. So, yes, it is frustrating to be in ASH. However, brain damage is prevented. You know, function level is not going to decrease. I don't know, I would recommend watching you know, maybe Lockdown or whatever that that show is called. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
And
I understand that it's horrible, but I'm just saying that there's a huge difference. I mean, we're talking like a third of my sentence would have been prison time. So like it's pretty substantial. I mean, to have a thing over your head for, you know, three times longer than you would have served.
It's understandable. So I guess the legislation has to be.
That's the other thing, Holly. Yeah. If you can advocate for us, like by providing us new laws, like instead of having the presumptive be the sentencing structure, could the judge actually, you know, tune that to each individual circumstance? So then that way, you know, we're not having to do this presumptive sentence and all of these things like that. We can be treated as an individual on an individual basis. I think that that would be really helpful for us. The second thing I would like to
ask. Good point going forward.
Yeah. And then the second thing that I would like to advocate for is maybe get more funding to get these risk assessments moving. I know that it's hard not to talk and it's hard to not talk in specific, but I know that a lot of people had issues with their attorneys even getting contact with their, like, I'm sure you've heard this whole thing because a lot of them don't even know that they have, you know, GEI patients. And so like, it would be good if like we can have like a subsection of the total defense attorneys like be treated or be, you know, trained in the GEI statute. Yeah. So then that way they're aware of what the laws are and what statutes that they can use, because a lot of times I'm even educating my attorney as to what laws are there.
I think,
so funding is definitely funding is definitely very, very important, because, you know, I mean, there's only so much Ash can do with what they get. And I will stop here.
A good point. Okay. I think, let me address the issue. There is a new Supreme Court committee that Josh Mozell was on. There are lots of prosecutors and some defense attorneys. But Josh and I have actually talked, and we're sort of tentatively trying to put together something to go. We're going to go around to every presiding judge in Arizona, to the counties, and talk about GEI defense. There are some excellent, excellent public defenders. There's not a better GEI defense lawyer than Tammy Ray, I would say, in any state in the country. And it was a highlight of my professional career, no exaggeration, to work with her and Dr. Robinson, Donna Robinson, along with Nancy Bartow on the bill. And ACME supported the bill. Lori is vice president of ACME. Chuck Goldstein is a treasurer. Barb is on the board. ACME was a major reason that that statute in the background got passed.
Yes, and can I piggyback on that? Okay, there is so much advocacy for Ash to get the funding that they need. You cannot even imagine. So I cannot go into much more details, but there's tremendous advocacy in that area.
We need to we need to be sure that we are emphasizing I guess fidelity, some fidelity measures, if you will. I hear complaints, I hear concerns about public defenders. My experience is obviously more limited than all the patients at ASH, but I think that is an excellent suggestion, Kay, and I want to sit down with Josh and Judge McDougall, retired judge who's also on the ACME board. This is not an ad for ACME. This is our space, and we're a little crazy about our advocacy. We're doing this at 8:18 on a Thursday night, right? So we are kind of everywhere, because that's what we made a commitment to do for our kids, our families. I think we need to look at this, and we need to find a collegial way to elevate Arizona's public, you know, how do we elevate this so that the public defenders working at ASH are the best of the best? And that's my takeaway from this meeting. And you've said it so well, Kay. You really have. I'm sorry, I should be saying K. You're it's yeah. K. Initial K, not K. K A Y.
Okay. So you have support. You have support. Okay. So people are working on this, and it takes a long time, but we're trying. Everybody's trying.
The last thing I do want to say is this, and this is going to sound a little touchy-feely, but I really believe in cultures of care. And I believe that a lot can be done at ASH through changing the culture of care to infuse a more therapeutic approach in day-to-day living there. And I've been in lots of other mental health institutions, and I've seen the good, the bad, the ugly, public and private. I have never seen more polite, careful, gracious staff than I did at Johns Hopkins in the locked psychiatric ward with very sick patients. And I've seen the opposite at other private hospitals. There, I think if I were going to change one thing at ASH in terms of the quality of the patients' lives, which Kay has been talking about, it can't feel like prison. And you can't punish schizophrenia out of somebody. Restricting someone who's at ASH with a very serious mental illness, there by order of a court because of a crime, when they were so sick they didn't know what they were doing was wrong. If you restrict that patient to the unit because they spit on the floor, or they're rude to staff, or they, you know, throw water or something like that, and that denies them, deprives them going to treatment groups, going outside, what have you accomplished?
A different administration.
No, I have patients restricted. I have clients restricted to unit right now for bad manners, for behavior that is completely reflective of what every client I have in a jail, in a clinic, in my office has done. And you can't, it should not, I mean, I really want to pass a statute that a patient cannot be ordered anywhere at ASH that deprives them of meaningful treatment. That makes no sense. We might as well call it jail, because it just doesn't make sense. And that doesn't take money. It takes a culture.
And that's why Lori and Mike and myself will meet and discuss, different ways and different venues or programming that will enhance the therapeutic programming.
Yeah, you can't punish bipolar out of somebody. You can't punish schizophrenia. You can't. You just can't do that. And and to your point, Janina, every day that somebody who's psychotic and on medication to control that psychosis, medication is most important, but therapy is important too. They could be on the same medication and be in a jail cell, but they're not getting treatment.
Yeah,
I don't believe you can get treatment in jail.
Let's move on.
Advocate for jail or prison. let's think positive here.
So any questions, because this wasn't intended to be a bashing of treatment at ASH. This is not Hopkins and not someone that's got large money and endowments and lots of doctors and money.
Not
and
saying
interns.
That culture doesn't politeness doesn't cost a dollar. It costs somebody knowing that if they treat patients like scum, they're going to pay the consequences. That's all I'm saying. Doesn't cost a dollar.
But I've seen, when our son was there, I've seen really caring patients from anyone from the janitors to the security guards,
of course,
everyone trying to help. And that he wasn't on forensic and he wasn't there long. But again, I think that it's a hard job as
yep.
reading through the incident and accident reports. I see you have a lot of patients that do act out, that are very sick, that have impulse control. It's not an easy job to do.
Right.
And they are on a shoestring budget and they have a, so any final questions? Because we still have to go to open forum, open public comment. Any questions for Dr. Potts or for Holly before we go to public comment?
Thank you, Ms. Goldstein, for permitting me to join your group. And, you know, that I respect what you're doing and I respect the patients there. Thank you.
Thanks, ditto Dr. What, Potts.
Ditto what Dr. Potts said.
Thank you.
Thanks, Holly and Dr. Potts for showing up tonight. It was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, so I think we're going to move to public comment. And since we're running so late, we're going to be strict on 3 minutes each. So we're not here till 9. So does anyone from the public want to make a comment? Going once.
Marcus Barron from Mojave.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about possibly having somebody come in because I've already spoken with my attorney about it, but he's telling me that I need to reach out to the team here, staff, or somebody who can help me get the correct answer. I'm trying to find out about funding for my invention. And I just would like to know exactly how to go about doing so.
Okay, so, we're not allowed to answer questions, but we can hear up. Okay.
Somebody try to answer the question right now, but if possible, somebody taking notes. My FAA number is 37473. I'm hoping that somebody can just look on my credentials to see that I'm telling you, hey, I have ideas that can actually help this hospital as well as myself. But due to my issues here, my patent attorney feels that it is a conflict of interest for him to work directly with me. And I've been working with him long before my incarceration. It's just a lack of funding, same issue as this hospital. Lack of funding that made it where I couldn't have my ideas be in his realm of investigating if there is anything similar around the world, you know, because that's what he's saying. He has to check everything from around the world. And, you know, obviously I didn't have the funding for that. But again, I have ideas for myself as well as for the hospital to make it so everybody can get ahead. I'm hoping that someone's taking notes. Again, this is Duarte Barron at Mojave.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anyone else?
He pooped on me, Steve.
You got
to mute
it.
Oh, God.
Okay, do we have anyone else that wants to make public comment? Okay, well, with no one stepping up, thank you, everyone. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Do we have a second?
I second. Barb seconds.
Okay. Okay, anyone against adjournment? Okay, we'll officially adjourn. Thank you, guys. See you May 15th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.